So Isaiah chapter 2. In days to come, the mountain of God's house shall be established as the highest of the mountains, and shall be raised above the hills, and all the nations shall stream to it, and many peoples shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of God, to the house of the God of Jacob and of Rachel, that God may teach us divine ways, and that we may walk in God's paths. For out of Zion shall go forth instruction, and the word of God from Jerusalem, and God shall judge between the nations, and shall arbitrate for many peoples, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks, and nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. Come, house of Jacob, come, let us walk in the light of God. Traditionally, the first Sunday of Advent is the time when we focus on God's coming. God's coming in Bethlehem, God's coming every day in our lives, and God's coming in some other way or not at the end of time, and all of those sort of get mixed up. So usually at the first of Advent, there's a reading from one of the Gospels about that final time. Or is it about that? That's always the question. So here's what Matthew has to say. But about that day and hour, no one knows. Neither the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but only God. For as in the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark, and they knew nothing until the flood came and swept them all away. So too will be the coming of the Son of Man. Then two will be in the field, and one will be taken and one will be left. Two women will be grinding meal together, and one will be taken and one will be left. Keep awake, therefore, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming. But understand this. If the owner of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have let the house be broken into. Therefore, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an unexpected hour. Here's a quote by John Dominic Crossan. The geographers tell us that we do not live on firm earth, but on giant moving plates whose grinding passage and tortured depths give us earthquakes and volcano. Jesus tells us that we do not live in firm time, but on giant shifting epochs whose transitions and changes are the advent of God. Jesus challenged his culture's view of time. It is not eternity and beyond he's talking about. It's advent now and within us. John Crossan. Advent is a call to a consideration of time. What it is, how we measure it, how we spend it, time as a commodity, time as a gift, time as a construct. Preparation time for Christmas in the world is often a time of hectic excitement. For some, it's soul-feeding, and for others, it's draining in every way, and maybe that depends for you on what season of your life you're in at any given Advent. Preparation time for Christmas in the church is called Advent and ought to be a time of depth, a time of saying to yourself, how are things with my soul? A time of looking at the world, this world that God created and loves so much, and saying, with God, where does the creation need to be mended? And what is a good and holy use of my time today? And so in the church, the color is deep blue. The music is often minor. The mood is one of waiting and wondering and sometimes weeping and wailing. Waiting not passively, but waiting actively with intent, lurking, watching for hope, which has so lately been on the run. No recent sightings reported in public or private life. Time is a funny thing. The church says Jesus is coming. Some say Jesus will return someday. Isaiah says, in days to come they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks, and nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. But when? And how? A lot depends on how you answer that, how you see time. Let me ask, if you were going to put world history on a graph, what would it look like? Do you see time like this? Do you think that we are sort of getting better and better? Would it go like that? Or, with some, do you think it's like, used to be really good and now it's just we're getting worse and worse? Or, would you graph it like this? Can you see that it makes a difference? And you find all three worldviews in the Bible, that's for sure, because on this subject, as on most others, Scripture does not speak with only one voice, which is why I love it. And the fascinating thing is that you can watch the New Testament authors themselves struggle with that, because at first, many expected Jesus' return immediately. Jesus had died, had been raised, and then was gone from them. He promised, some said, that he would come back. And many believed it would be immediately and in bodily form. And so they lived their lives accordingly. Because they thought he was coming back, and if you asked them when, they would have checked watches, not the calendar, like any time now. Certainly within their lifetimes, they believed. Partly because of that, nobody wrote down anything. Nobody ever dreamed in those earliest days that there would be people who would need to know in the future, that there would be another generation of them who had never heard of these things. And so for a long time, nobody wrote anything or didn't think it was necessary. But as time went on, and he did not return as soon as they thought, or at least in the way they thought, and some of them who knew Jesus began to die, they thought, we better write this down. And so the Gospels were written and other things as well. There were many Gospels, of them we have four. And in those Gospels we see the church struggling with the fact that Jesus is not coming back when or how they thought. And you can read parables in there about the landowner who went away and left his servants in charge and no one knew when he was coming back. What is that, if not that struggle? And finally, you see them coming to the conclusion that Jesus is, in fact, among them. He has returned already. At least some of them believe that, because in Matthew 25, just after what I read, we read Matthew saying, if you want to meet Jesus here and now, then look to the poor. That famous thing, I was in prison and you visited me. I was naked and you clothed me. I was hungry and you gave me food. And they'll say, Lord, when did we do that? And Jesus said, when you did that to the least of these, you did it to me. Jesus is here right now, so don't be waiting. Don't be waiting. All of this Matthew is writing, and the other gospel writers too, in the rubble of the temple that had been so recently destroyed by Roman soldiers. And for them, the sacred part of their lives, the sacred part of the world had been destroyed. And when you listen to Matthew's words, you have to listen. Otherwise, we do the text such a disservice. We listen to this while we stand beside those who have been traumatized by that violence. The survivors, those mourning the deaths of friends in that battle, the shell shock soldiers, probably just young, some of them, and newly aware that the job of a soldier was not all glamorous, but cruel and soul-sucking and left you empty inside. And as you listen to those words of Matthew, you listen as you must, standing with those who are starving and addicted. And all of them longing and wondering, when will God be with us? Ever? Ever? Is there even a God? When will it be? It's all there, the coming of God among them. Is it some distant future? Is it right here and right now? And what about the past? What about Bethlehem? So yes and yes and yes. And Matthew says, keep your eyes open, because not everyone gets it. And sometimes the time isn't right. But sometimes it is. Sometimes the time is exactly right. Time, it's a funny thing. Not all time is the same. Sometimes it seems like there's a shifting and an opening, and pregnancy is a good image for that. Sometimes the time is exactly right, and you've got to be awake, you've got to be alert. Did anybody listen to Mary Hines' interview on CBC with Ronald Purser, the author of a book called McMindfulness? Purser himself is a Buddhist monk, a scholar, a practitioner of mindfulness for years, as Buddhists are. He was talking about the mindfulness industry, and that in his opinion, it's been detached from its spiritual and religious roots and intent, and now serves the status quo. He said it's used for soldiers to desensitize them to what they have to do. He said that it can serve to keep us asleep and powerless. Things would just be better in my life and the world if I just practiced this mindfulness alone, just me and my inner world, no connection to a community, no acknowledgement that what's wrong in your life is at least partly due to an economic and political system that serves the wealthy and tries to keep the rest of us asleep, because if we woke up, we'd be so angry, we'd do something about it. So this year, when I hear Jesus say, stay awake, I'm hearing him say, do not use mindfulness, whatever. Do not use your own religion. Do not use Christianity. Do not use your own spirituality, prayer life, your own practices as a way to stay asleep to suffering and the outer work of what God is up to in the world, as well as your own life. Stay awake, because God is most certainly up to something in here and out there, and you don't want to miss it. This season I've been on Facebook, as you know, with people from my life in other places. And I'm just going to tell you about two people, all three. First is a young woman, now in her late 20s. She's dreadfully unhappy. She's been unhappy for a long time, and she spends her days on Facebook posting about how unhappy she is, and telling the anonymous world rather than the people who need to hear about it in person. But recently, she seems ready for a change. There's a change in her. She's no longer, for example, cutting herself to focus the pain. And she's moving to a new location. And it seems like there's something that has opened up for her, a door, a glimpse, and she's stepping into it. Family, my second example, a family who's been estranged for years. Some of its members are making overtures to others who are accepting those overtures. And trust me when I tell you that for this family, that's huge. And finally, a friend who just turned 50 and is now remembering and beginning to deal with some trauma from her youth. I know you all have stories like that, and they're not only personal ones, but all of these stories, for them, it's like an Advent time, waiting and struggling, but something is trying to be born. And for some reason, who knows, this is the time. And they're seeing and acting on an opening. It's Advent time for them. And if that isn't God breaking in, I don't know what is. Who knows? and what that's like for you. Times like that can come quickly, sometimes brought on by something, often at midlife. Have you noticed that? Or it can be, I don't know, the time just seems right somehow. And I know that speaking in this way is a middle-class luxury, and that for many in the world, dealing with childhood trauma or family brokenness are just not possible when you have to worry about what you're going to feed your baby tonight. This is World AIDS Day, just for example. It's also the anniversary of the day, December 1st, 1955, that Rosa Parks refused to go to the back of the bus. And later this week, December 6th, will be the 30th anniversary of the Montreal Massacre at École Polytechnique. These are signs of the sins, deep, ugly sins, of racism, misogyny, homophobia. We only have to look at the news to answer those who might say, well, that was then, this is now. In the world, too, though, it seems as though there are times when things are just right. Who knew that the Berlin Wall would fall when it did? There might have been a whole build-up to that, but it seemed like it was like, oh, all of a sudden. Who knew that a little girl from Sweden would inspire so many? Who knew? Sometimes there are opportunities for hope that break open when we are at our most despairing, like a door suddenly appears, a room of requirement. What Matthew is calling us to, I believe, is to be alert. Keep eyes open, keep your antenna up, able to recognize an Advent opportunity when one is presented, and maybe even help it along. One thing I found helpful from this week is Isaiah's expression, training for war. Neither shall they learn war or train for war anymore. We'll prepare ourselves best, I think, by not training for war. Discipline ourselves to think in terms of possibility and promise and cooperation and life and peace. For too long, the world has trained us for war, teaching us to think us and them. Bigger is better, loudest is right. For me to win, you have to lose. We enter discussions often armed, yes, armed, with reasons that we're right. And when we listen to others, we're already forming what we're going to say next. And we enter meetings ready for a fight, expecting opposition, planning ways to win, assuming that those who have a different opinion also have malicious intent. It's the way of the world. This is training for war. This is forming our minds and our thinking to only one way of looking at the world, and the way we speak and the way we imagine and conceptualize things becomes flesh and dwells among us. And in this way, we create our worlds. May I suggest that we challenge ourselves this Advent season that we do not train for war anymore. That we begin by getting enough sleep, just for starters. I always wondered, what would politics, world politics, be like if all the leaders and people who make decisions got enough sleep? And enough exercise to keep our spirits alert, that we discipline our hearts and minds to discern the movement of the Spirit, the infant possibilities for hope and peace. And finally this, I'm sure I've said this to you before, two images help me when I'm at my own most hopeless. The first is this. Do you remember when you were 15 and had a hopeless crush on someone who didn't know you existed? I'm afraid that happens. What did you do? You hung around in places where you were likely to run into that person. Right? You knew where they hung out, and so you hung out there too. I'm suggesting that when we are hopeless, we treat hope like that. That if you need hope, go to where you're likely to run into it. Just be around others who are hopeful. Just be where it is. You never know what might happen. And the second is this. This might sound silly to you. but I have in my head an image of a huge vat in the sky, and in that vat is hope for the world. And sometimes it's pretty full and sometimes not so much. And when I pray at night, I review my day and I ask myself, have I contributed to the amount of hope in that thing? Have my words and my actions put more hope in that vat? Is it fuller this evening because of how I've lived my life? I'm going to read a poem by Seamus Heaney, one of my favorites, and I'll close with that. Heaney says this: human beings suffer, they torture one another, they get hurt, and no poem or play or song can fully right a wrong inflicted and endured. History says, don't hold on the side of the brave. But then, once in a lifetime, the longed-for tidal wave of justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme. So hope for a great sea, change on the far side of revenge. Believe that a further shore is reachable from here. Believe in miracles and cures and healing wells. Call miracle self-healing, the utter self-revealing double take of feeling. If there's fire on the mountain and lightning and storm and God speaks from the sky, that means someone is hearing the outcry and the birth cry of new life at its turn. It means that once in a lifetime that justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme. Keep awake, my friends. The time is coming and already is. The time is ripe. And something is waiting to be born. May it be born in us.